You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpere Thursday. My name is Jessica and I'm your host today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Beth. Efai Akine coming up on the show. Spike interviews President of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Layan Khalil, about protests against Israeli-owned shipping vessels and goods entering Aotearoa. Caster speaks to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland and Chair of Te Rūnanga a Iwi, or Ngāti Kahu, of the Far North, Margaret Mutu, about the new government and how it will impact Māori and Te Tiriti. Caster also speaks to CEO of Safe for Animals, Deborah Ashton, about the government repealing the ban on live exports. I speak to Associate Professor of Journalism at Massey University in Wellington, James Hollings, about Winston Peters' false allegations of media bribery concerning the Public Interest Journalism Fund. I also speak to Director at our Land and Water National Science Challenge, Jenny Webster Brown, and Research Lead and Director of Land, Water, People, Ton Snelder, about their new research into New Zealand's water quality. Beth, what have you got for us today?
For City Counselling, I speak to Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about proposed congestion charges. I also speak to Professor of Education at the University of Auckland, Katie Fitzpatrick, about the government's plan to remove relationships and sexuality education guidelines from the curriculum.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka owe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo ano hi pākihere roki roki mā runga e te pai tuku tuku o irurangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. And you can catch all of these pieces and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
The Wire. I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
The incoming government, particularly ACT New Zealand First, have campaigned on removing or reducing the impact of Te Tiriti or Waitangi on politics after releasing their policy agreements last week. Caster spoke to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, about the government's obligations to Māori and how some of those proposed policies might affect them. Here is that interview now.
A lot of the policies promised on Friday are aimed at Te Tiriti and trying to limit its influence on politics. Are these politicians required to follow treaty principles, or is it more of an option for them?
In terms of the treaty, that was the agreement, that was the legal basis upon which British immigrants could come into this country. This government, or the particularly ACT, and to a certain extent New Zealand First as well, is trying to do away with the treaty. We need to be quite clear about that. So David Seymour in particular has articulated in the run-up to the election his wish to see the treaty gone and to see there being no recognition at all of Māori as the indigenous people of this country. His take on it is that everybody is equal, no one's different in any way from anybody else. What this does is it takes back policy in this country back to the 1960s. And in the 1960s, there was a very well-known report called the Hun Report that said that Māori had to evolve to become brown Pākehā, and the only thing in the Māori world that was allowed to survive was whatever Pākehā said could survive, and that was things like arts and crafts, kapa haka, but not much else. This coalition government, at the behest of ACT in particular, but also with the support of New Zealand First, is trying to take us back to that. Now, is the government at all obliged under the treaty? Of course it's obliged. This country, the whole setup of this country, is supposed to have been done out of the Treaty of Waitangi. Without the Treaty of Waitangi, the whole political infrastructure you have at the moment would not exist. So it's as fundamental as that, because the treaty is part of the constitutional basis of this country. And the parent document to the treaty is He Haka Putanga o Te Rangatiratanga o New Tirini, which is the 1835 Declaration of Independence. So in short, the answer to your question is yes, of course, they must abide by Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the treaty that was signed and agreed to between the rangatira of the hapū and the Queen of England.
While ACT has expressed intent to get rid of Te Tiriti, particularly from David Seymour, New Zealand First has instead promised to remove or replace all mention of treaty principles in existing legislation. Is this in line with the government's obligations under Te Tiriti?
Absolutely not. Now, this is, of course, something that New Zealand First has been trying to get across the line for at least a couple of decades. And what has always been said is it's just the principles that they want to get rid of. However, when Winston Peters came to the University of Auckland to talk to us about this, we did ask him quite specifically whether it was the principles he wanted to get rid of or whether it was the treaty itself, and he wouldn't answer the question. So I think you can safely assume that New Zealand First wants to get rid of any reference to the treaty in any form, in any legislation, and that is a massive violation of the treaty. It is as bad as David Seymour's attempt to just completely wipe out the treaty. They have the same aim in mind.
The government has promised to remove all Māori names from government organisations not explicitly related to Te Ao Māori, with Winston Peters particularly focused on waka kotahi, asking, how can you have a waka on the road? I'd like to ask you, can you have a waka on the road?
Winston Peters is not a speaker of Māori, and waka actually just means a vehicle. And a waka can be on the sea. On the land, it'll be a car or a truck or a whatever else. So, sorry, Winston, you don't know the meaning of the word waka. It just means a vehicle, so, a means of transport. So, yes, you can have a waka on a road, and we have heaps of them. On the naming of government departments, there isn't a single government department that is actually compliant with Te Tiriti or Waitangi and has at its base things Māori. Tikanga Māori, Māori law. There is not a single government department that does that. And I find it quite disingenuous that they use Māori names. So this might be a little bit unusual, but I happen to agree that that using Māori names for government departments is wrong. What they're often trying to do is fudge what those departments do. The classic one is Oranga Tamariki. Now that Oranga Tamariki means the well-being of children, the health and well-being of children. That is not what that department does. It is the Ministry of Children, and it treats children abysmally. It cannot call itself something to do with the well-being of children. So that's a classic example. But I happen to agree with New Zealand First on that one. Change them all to English names, because they are English, they are Pākehā departments.
Lastly, do you have anything you'd like to add on?
The two coalition agreements are really, really clear that this is a government that is very anti-Māori. And it's going to systematically strip back, so it says, every single means of progress, every single benefit that we have been able to fight for and get over the last three decades. They want to strip the whole lot away. And that for Māori is unforgivable, and it's just not. It has made a lot of Māori leaders very, very angry. So I've been fielding a lot of phone calls from Māori leaders as to what we're going to do. You will have been hearing a lot of Māori leaders being interviewed and very, very angry about what's being done in the health sector, what's being done in local government, what's being done in terms of prisons, right across the sector. This is a huge backward step, and Māori are very angry.
That was Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland and Chair of Te Rūnanga a Iwi o Ngātu Kahu of the Far North, Margaret Mutu, on the incoming government and its impact on Māori.
Hey, I'm Paddy Gower and this is F***ing BFM.
Last week, protesters blockaded the ports of Auckland entrance in an attempt to stop the entry of an Israeli-owned shipping vessel and its goods. Spike spoke to President of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Layan Khalil, about the aim of the sit-in.
So what protest took place last Thursday at the ports of Auckland?
So it was the whole idea of protesting against the Zim containers. So Zim is an Israeli company that transports cargo in and out of New Zealand. So the idea was to kind of protest and let the ports know and the unions and the workers inside there that we're against these Israeli containers being on New Zealand shores. So that was the whole idea. It did happen to be a blockade as well, where we had some of the protesters actually sit in a picket line and physically stop the trucks from going in and out, which was really helpful and really good. So that was pretty much the overall.
What is Zim's shipping relation to the Israeli government?
So it's a very big Israeli corporation, like a big organisation. They don't really ship, I think, they don't ship goods necessarily. From what I've been reading recently and sort of hearing from people is that they don't really ship Israeli goods necessarily, but it's just that an Israeli organisation, an Israeli corporation owns these containers that goods are shipped in. So part of our protest is to also urge these companies that use the Zim containers to ship to stop doing that and perhaps find other container companies.
And this follows similar protests in recent weeks against the arrival of Israeli vessels in Australia, Canada and America. How do you feel protests like this impact the Israeli occupation in Gaza?
First of all, it limits their economic funding, which is really the biggest issue for us here. Another way is that it tells the government that, you know, what you guys are actually doing is genuinely wrong and people around the world are protesting against that. So it harms them economically, which is the biggest concern.
Yeah, these past few months have seen the largest amount of support for Palestine in, I guess, modern history, especially both in Aotearoa and abroad. Where do you see the wider movement going from here?
Honestly, I really see a permanent ceasefire coming soon. We did get a humanitarian pause, which is absolute bullshit, I would say. But I think with all the countries and all the governments hopefully listening to their protesters, listening to their citizens and actually take a stand in a worldwide sort of document or worldwide stance that, okay, we actually have to stop this and demand a permanent ceasefire and also take out all the illegal settlers in Palestine.
How have you felt about the, I guess, local groundswell that's been going on, like the marches in Queen Street and across the country, and some of the more, I guess, direct action that's been going on?
Yeah, so marches and protests are really good, the ones that have been happening weekly, but it is a very peaceful rally and it can only get you so much. It felt like we were protesting for 5, 6, 7 weeks and almost nothing has been done, so we had to take the initiative of, okay, let's start with non-violent direct actions, and which is what we keep on emphasizing, that it's non-violent and it is peaceful, but it is a form of direct action and it is a form of public disruption, which really is a very main component in protesting.
Do you feel these sorts of non-violent direct actions fall under the boycott, divest and sanction movement, or this is kind of an evolution of pro-Palestinian protest?
It's kind of of both, but we are very big on BDS, and you know, we are asking our port to boycott these containers, and we are sanctioning Israel by doing so. So we definitely are listening to what BDS, you know, demands from us as protesters and us as like civilians in these countries. So we are doing what they want us to do.
And around 40 police officers were present at the protest on Thursday. What actions did they take to break the blockade?
So there was a lot of pushing. There was tackling, which we have all seen in, you know, videos evident of that. I would say the police were more on the violent side, as, you know, we have seen at the end of the day, our protest is non-violent and peaceful. So it just felt unnecessary to have these sort of altercations or just this unnecessary force and disproportionate force from the police onto the protesters peacefully protesting.
Are future protests being planned currently?
Yes, we are actually just in a meeting preparing for Thursday. So it'll be Thursday at 4:30 in the same place at the port. And then hopefully we're going to have larger numbers and then we can go for it.
Yeah, if people want to get involved on Thursday, is there anything else they should know or where can they get more information?
There's so many information posted on our page, so UOASJP, and then there's Action for Palestine and Sana Aotearoa. It's got all the details that we need to know in terms of legal rights and sort of like what to bring on the day and these things.
That was Spike speaking to President of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Layan Khalil, about their protest against the arrival of Israeli vessels in Aotearoa.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Keep it on the B.
The Karangahape Record Fair is back.
With stacks of grooves to be found from the region's finest traders.
Selling sought-after sonics from every era.
With DJs Warren P, Scarlett, Christoph Altrinto and Marianne. Plus
raffles, coffee and simple kai.
A community congregation for all.
From dusty-fingered veterans to record newbies.
The Karangahape Record Fair 2023. Sunday, 3rd of December, 11 till 3 p.m. at Hopetown Alpha. $5 on the door, tamariki free. This is a cash event only. For more info, check the Karangahape Record Fair on Instagram.
The original originator.
95.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Of course, it is within this.
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed. Some of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Welcome back to The Wire. For this week's City Counselling, I caught up with Auckland Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson. We spoke about congestion charges, which could come into effect as soon as 2025. Wayne Brown has previously proposed congestion charges of between $3.50 and $5 during peak hours for car users on State Highways 1 between Penrose and Green Lane and State Highway 16 between Lincoln Road and Te Ata Tū Road. Here is that interview.
How would the congestion charges work?
Well, there's a few different methods. I mean, one of them could be that you were to essentially toll the motorway. So, you know, you pay roll tolls and you go on kind of the northern motorway up north, that kind of stuff. That would be one way of doing it. Another way of doing it that they do in different parts of the world is they put a cordon around the city centre. And so if you drive through that cordon during peak times, then you get charged for it. So it's kind of much of a muchness, but these are the key details that actually make a big difference as to whether the system is sort of fair for everybody and those kind of things. So when we do consult, which will likely be early next year, I actually really want to hear about how people think that we should be operating that charge. And we're all still really open to how that's going to work.
Do you think congestion charges are necessary?
I think it is necessary in terms of breaking that congestion, which is such a drain on both kind of the local economy here in Auckland, but also people's kind of transport choices, climate change, air pollution. There's a bunch of reasons why you should do it. My message to Auckland is, from my perspective, is, yeah, let's give it a go, but we'll also make sure that it's fair and equitable, because we've developed as a city over many decades with some deep unfairness in our kind of planning system, and we don't want to punish families that have to move to outer suburban Auckland because of how we plan the city and kind of the economics of it all. So, yeah, ultimately, we should do it, but we should also look at how we can do this fairly.
Congestion is particularly bad in West Auckland, often outside of peak hours. In the northwest, there's just one highway and no train service. What does Auckland Council propose for car users in parts of West Auckland, like the northwest, where there is little alternative?
Yeah, well, that will be part of the consultation, right? But I will be consulting really hard and kind of leading that charge in the northwest to get a fair situation for them, because, you know, there are parts of the city, and the northwest is definitely one, but there's others too, where there's no real choice but to drive. Now, things are getting better, but I would argue that if you are to pay the charge, then you should be seeing the results of that charge back into your community. So we should be reinvesting in bus services and those kind of things to give people real alternatives to kind of avoid that congestion charge. Because if it's unavoidable, you know, it's hardly fair. We're trying to encourage people to get on buses and trains and whatnot, and that's still not a reality for every Aucklander.
Will congestion charges be applied elsewhere in Tamaki Makaurau in time?
Yeah, so one of the proposals that has sort of come out in the media and so forth is to look at different motorway arterials. So the northwest would be one, but you'd also be looking at the North Shore or South Auckland or all of the above or none of the above, right? It's all still up in the air. But, yeah, there's every chance that we'll be looking at different parts of Auckland, not just the northwest. But it kind of goes back to what I was saying, is you've got to make it fair for people.
When can we expect these congestion charges to come into effect?
Yeah, well, it's kind of still how long is a piece of string at the moment, because we're waiting on the new government to firstly look at whether they will be repealing the regional fuel tax, which this will be a replacement regime for. And then we've got to go to consultation. And so, you know, I'm going to say really broad strokes, you'd be looking at least a year, I would say. But consultation is scheduled for early next year. And then from there, we'll have a little bit more clarity on when that's going to come through.
That was Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson speaking to me about proposed congestion charges during peak hours for State Highways 1 and 16.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Councilling on 95 BFM.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison Company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Recently, we have seen members of the new coalition government be increasingly critical towards the media. In particular, this week we saw New Zealand First leader Winston Peters falsely accuse media of accepting government bribery in the form of the Public Interest Journalism Fund. I spoke to Associate Professor of Journalism at Massey University in Wellington, James Hollings, about the purpose of the fund and state-funded media, as well as the potential implications of some members of the incoming government's attitudes towards the media. Can you tell our listeners who may not know about this fund what it was intended for?
Well, the fund was set up by the then Labor government back in about 2019, I think, and it was really a response to two things. First of all, the really sort of alarming decline in advertising revenue in the mainstream New Zealand media, or all New Zealand media, as Google and Facebook and others were sucking a lot of advertising money out of the media. And so, I don't know if you remember, but what is Stuff was owned by Fairfax Australia at the time, and it was then almost broke. It was bought by a New Zealand journalist, Sinead Boucher. So there was a real feeling that New Zealand media was under threat and needed some sort of support. This is a worldwide thing. Governments are looking at how they can support media with subsidies in various places in Europe given to news media. And so New Zealand was sort of part of that trend. The other thing, of course, that happened was the pandemic, and that put huge pressures on journalism, as it did everyone, with journalists having to work from home and not being able to get into jobs. And that's the second thing. I guess one third thing would be there's, an awareness by the then Labor government that New Zealand media needed more diversity in it and more particularly Māori and Pacifica voices in it. So it was a real attempt to redress that by funding specifically young Māori to get into journalism training and organisations to take on specifically Māori and Pacifica roles, but overall also to boost capacity of journalism. Big problem in New Zealand journalism, as in other countries, is what they call news deserts. In other words, as the media dollar, advertising dollar has shrunk, news organisations are pulling back from small scale, shrinking their regional newsrooms. Just a lot of stuff not being covered, which used to be covered, so local councils, courts, that sort of thing. And so the Journalism Fund was also trying to redress that by specifically funding reporters who go and report on the local councils and report on courts, and to replace the reporters which were no longer there, which could no longer be funded by the mainstream media. That's in a nutshell what the club was trying to do.
And state-funded media, including media that had funding from the Public Interest Journalism Fund, are editorially independent. Can you tell our listeners a bit about what this looks like in practice?
State-funded media, which is Radio New Zealand and Television New Zealand, are required by law under their governing act to be editorially independent. And ministers, no minister of the Crown, may direct or try and influence that independence. And we saw Winston Peters come very close to the wind on this, in terms of breaking this law on Monday, when straight after swearing, being sworn in as Deputy Prime Minister, he came out and said that he'd be wanting to see how quickly TV New Zealand and Radio New Zealand moved to reduce their, I think, their Māori, use of Māori language, in accordance with this sort of edict that's or wish of direction that's coming out from the current government about reducing that in public service organisations. So that would be very, very close to the wind in terms of breaching the act and not giving any direction to TV New Zealand or Radio New Zealand. So he didn't really be pulled up on that, but someone should, because it's really quite out of line what he did in terms of playing in there. So these state organisations are required to be editorially independent. Of course, private sector organisations pride themselves on being editorially independent from governments and various other groups. That's how they sell their message to the audience, to the readers, that we are independent, we're acting on your behalf, not on behalf of some shadowy sort of private, corporate or government interest.
Do you have any concerns about how the government's attitudes towards the media could affect public trust in the media in Aotearoa?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's a good question because some really great research has been done by AUT media scholars, Marie Malavati and Greg Treadwell, among others, about public trust in journalism in New Zealand. And what we've seen, what they've seen, is a really quite disturbing decline in public trust in journalism in the past 3 years, particularly in the past year. And that's across all types of news media, not just left-wing or, you know, or right-wing, for example. So Radio New Zealand, TV New Zealand, News Talk, ZB have all dropped about 12-14% in terms of public trust. And that's quite a big drop in 1 year. Brings them back down to sort of internationally sort of comparable levels, you know, sort of compared with Australia or the UK or Canada. They were a bit above that beforehand. And one of the reasons that's been suggested for that drop in trouble at public trust is that concern about the Public Interest Journalism Fund and some of the sort of spin that's been out there that it's a government bribe and so on from various people. And so that kind of rhetoric, from particularly from the Deputy Prime Minister, it's one thing hearing from someone in opposition, but from the Deputy Prime Minister, is not going to help public trust in journalism in New Zealand. And we heard Judith Collins on Morning Report just yesterday, or Monday rather, saying, Tuesday rather, saying how concerned she, well, the media has a very important place in democracy, and she acknowledges that. So, you know, there's some elements of the current government that are very sort of staunch and, I think, responsible about and understand the role of the media in upholding democracy, that it's a very symbiotic relationship. And there seem to be some elements that just don't. So it's hard to know exactly how it's going to play out. I think it's been interesting because National doesn't really have a media policy in many senses. It doesn't have a broadcasting policy going into the election. New Zealand First did have a very clear and articulated, and some way actually quite reasonable, broadcasting policy. And they really wanted the ministerial portfolio for broadcast, and they didn't get it. They got an undersecretary role there. So you can see, you know, where there's a vacuum, people will fill it. And I think Winston's already sort of seems to be doing that by his comments about the media. So exactly how much influence New Zealand First is going to be able to have on the new government in terms of filling up that sort of policy vacuum in broadcasting and media in general is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
That was Associate Professor of Journalism at Massey University in Wellington, James Hollings, discussing the role of publicly funded media in Aotearoa and the incoming government's media policy.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
At the end of April this year, the former Labour government introduced a ban on live animal exports. The ban followed a two-year transition period, giving farmers and businesses a chance to find alternatives. The policy documents revealed last Friday indicated that the incoming government plans to repeal this ban. Castor spoke to CEO of Safe for Animals, Deborah Ashton, about why they believe this ban was put in place and what repealing it could mean.
Could you briefly explain what Safe is and what it does?
Yeah, so Safe is a animal rights organisation, and we have a goal of stopping animal exploitation. We're a voice for animals and represent and defend their rights. We run campaigns that may involve discussions with animal use industries, members of the public and politicians. We run petitions and other actions such as protests. And we've taken the government to court twice, once on the matter of farrowing crates, which are used for mother pigs. We won that case where the court said that farrowing crates were a violation of the Animal Welfare Act. And we also took the government to court for the use of animals used in rodeo, but we're just waiting to see what the how the government will follow up on that particular issue.
What sort of risks does live export pose for the animals involved?
Oh, it's huge. Voyages by sea are really harrowing for the animals. Even on purpose-built ships, they're not going to be immune to breakdowns or adverse weather events, and also they can sometimes be fatal, as we've seen around the world. The animals are most likely going to be sent to China again, so the animals will be raised and slaughtered in ways that could be seen as illegal here in this country. And as far as I'm aware, nothing has changed in China since the ban was put in place by our previous government. In New Zealand, we have laws about how animals have to be raised and slaughtered, but in China, they don't have animal protection laws to monitor the welfare, and there's nothing specific in their legislation to ensure that the animals are slaughtered humanely like they would be here. So I guess the biggest concern is for the welfare of those animals themselves. Many of the cattle will be pregnant as well. They're being sent over there for breeding purposes. And you can imagine, it's not a nice thing to put animals on board those ships and send them to countries where we just have no control of their welfare at all.
If the process was banned, what would those businesses do in its place?
I mean, that's a question for the industry itself. They've been sending millions of bobby calves to the slaughterhouses for many, many years. They're still doing that even though we have a ban on live export. So I think this is a much bigger question around what happens for cows that have been raised here in New Zealand. But we can't be putting profit ahead of animal welfare, which is what live export is going to allow. So basically, animals are going to be treated badly and people are going to be making money from it.
Is there anything else you'd like to add on?
Well, we've had the new Minister for Agriculture, Todd McClay, who's responsible. He has publicly said that animals wouldn't be going to the Middle East unless they could meet very, very high standards. But the reality is that we don't have proof, or he doesn't have proof, of the standards in China or anywhere else for that matter. So I think sending animals away to countries that already don't have legal welfare laws to protect those animals just isn't possible. We have enough of our own problems here ensuring the welfare of animals, and trying to send them off somewhere else where we have no control is really a bad idea. We saw the Australian Exporter Supply Chain Assurance System that completely collapsed because it was supposed to protect animals being exported over to Jordan, but investigators found abhorrent cruelty inside the slaughterhouse there, and that had been approved under this particular scheme. So this is the reality. You can have assurance schemes or agreements and various things like that to protect animals, but unless you're there actively involved, there's nothing you can really do to ensure their welfare and their safety.
That was CEO of Safe for Animals, Deborah Ashton, discussing the new government's plans to repeal a ban on live exports.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Keep it on the B.
Light the torches! Sound the trumpets! Make sure you've got the...
Johnny, did you get the ice?
What?
Come on, Johnny.
Prepare for the triumphant return of Thompson Whiskey to 95BFM's Cocktail Corner. They've scaled the soaring heights of success. They've won awards, travelled the globe, and now they're back with those sweet boys who love them. Can I get that trumpet again? Nice! Cocktail Corner, every Thursday evening, only on 95BFM Drive. Brought to you by Thompson Whiskey, available nationwide at all good bottle stores. Hit up thompsonwhiskey.com.
The ice jaws!
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11pm, only on 95BFM.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The new government has announced a plan to remove and replace relationship and sexuality education guidelines, citing the need for a return to an achievement-based curriculum rather than what they've referred to as an ideological one. I spoke to Professor of Education at the University of Auckland, Katie Fitzpatrick, about the new policy and what this means for rangatahi. Here is that interview. To begin, can you tell us a bit about the implementation of these gender and sexuality guidelines in 2020 and why their presence in the curriculum is important?
Yeah, sure. The guidelines are actually called Relationships and Sexuality Education Guidelines. So I think that's an important distinction in terms of the way that gender is being bandied about right now in all kinds of ways. So the guidelines actually have quite a history. So the first version was actually in 2002. They were updated in 2015 under the National Government. That they, you know, were keen to do that work. And then in 2020, the 2020 version is also an update that was sort of sponsored and actually led by Tracy Martin, who was a, you know, minister in the previous government and a New Zealand First Minister. So I think that's kind of interesting in that they've been integral to leading and developing and sponsoring this work, and now they are wanting to you know, cancel it or delete or, you know, interrupt sexuality and relationships education in schools. So I think that's something that I'm really concerned about, is that New Zealand First never signalled this in their pre-election manifesto at all, that they were thinking of removing the, you know, removing relationships and sexuality education guidelines from schools. So a lot of young people are really angry about it, and they feel like it's a bit of a betrayal of hard-fought work that had gone on to advocate for better relationships and sexuality education. I mean, I don't know how good your relationships and sexuality education was when you went to school, but there's a lot of young people who see that there's a lot of room for improvement in the space.
Yeah, it wasn't very holistic. There was a lot of room for improvement, and that was with the guidelines.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the purpose. I mean, the guidelines were in some ways a response to calls from young people. We saw three different petitions to Parliament, you know, between from 2017 onwards, actually specifically asking for better relationships education, better consent education, better sexuality education. And a lot of that is because of the changing nature of the environments that we're living in. You know, we know that young people are now living in an intensely digital age where there's freely accessible pornography, dating is on apps, you know, Instagram and TikTok are key sites of information about body image and identity.
Mm.
We have high sexual violence statistics, and young people are saying, actually, we need to learn about this. We want to talk about this. We want to understand. We want to build skills. We want to know how to support our friends. We want to think critically about this stuff. So they really want that learning in schools. So I think the move to remove relationships and sexuality education in schools is sort of a direct move against that, against what young people want.
What kind of message does this policy send, do you think?
Well, it's hard to know at this point. The wording in the coalition agreement is just the removal and replacement. So I think it's sending a message that there's going to be an intervention in this space from the government. But I think we don't know what that might be. It is slightly troubling in that, you know, this is not an area that young people have seen as problematic. There are some, there's misinformation out in various, you know, social media channels, et cetera, and in communities that is creating fear about gender and gender identity and expression. And for me, that's exactly the reason that we need to talk about it in schools. We need to try and understand so that the fear agenda, the fear, is not driving the conversation. Gender is not actually a scary thing. It's just something that we're all living and thinking about, and that young people have busted open, you know, the binary ideas of gender that have been quite regressive for a long time. So I think that's exciting, and we want to have that conversation. You know, the conversation shouldn't be driven by fear.
The new government has said that the current relationships and sexuality education guidelines are ideological. Do you agree?
Well, I think all curriculum and all government documents, actually, all national policies have different ideologies in them. Ideologies are just theories and bases of knowledge. So, of course, but there's a range of different theories that circulate in curriculum. And from an education perspective, good curriculum actually looks at different theories, looks at the bases of different arguments and different forms of knowledge and, you know, different research traditions, and seeks to understand those rather than say that some are good or bad, but to question them, to trouble them, to understand them so that we understand the different perspectives, for example, on gender. I think that's healthy for us to look at what different arguments are and where those arguments come from, what the political bases of those arguments are, what the knowledge traditions are, and then to try and understand them and what effects they have. So I think what worries me is that the idea that we might remove content about gender from curriculum is kind of silly. You know, gender is everywhere. We're all grappling with gender and identity and what that means. And so let's learn about it. Let's think about it. Let's talk about it rather than shut down that conversation.
Do you think that the policy itself and its intent to remove relationships and sexuality education guidelines is rooted in ideology?
Yes, absolutely. We know that there's been, you know, advocacy from right-wing religious groups and from, you know, trans-exclusionary groups that want to reinscribe, you know, the gender binary. So I think it's very ideological, of course. I think the term gender ideology and how it's being used here as a weapon is quite silly because, like I said, if all policy documents, all government policy has various ideologies that can be seen in it. And those are, like I said, different knowledge traditions, different theories that come from different places on the political spectrum and from different research traditions. So understanding what those are, I think, is interesting rather than just dismissing something with a term that gets, you know, used in quite a lazy way.
The rejection and sort of dismissal of the guidelines as ideology seems almost as though it's a sort of rejection of critical thinking, which I think is incredibly important, particularly in such a polarized time.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, New Zealand First, if you look at their manifesto, they suggest that they want more critical thinking in schools. That was part of their platform. So this goes directly against that. I think it's also a denial of youth culture and young people's worlds. I don't think there's very many people under 30 who would suggest that the removal of relationships and sexuality education is a reasonable move. You know, young people have advocated exactly for the opposite. And so I think we're seeing this real generational gap in understanding, you know, digital worlds, the world of dating and intimacy, the need for consent education, the kind of shift we've seen against sexual violence, the inclusion of takatāpui and LGBTQI young people. You know, it's a move that sort of directly goes against all of those things that are actually really normal in young people's worlds now and that we want to grapple with and understand and think about. So for me, this is a move that seems quite out of touch with young people in a very direct way.
Do you think the government's intention to remove relationships and sexuality education guidelines in schools has the potential to alienate and harm certain individuals and communities?
Yeah, I think the message that this sends is concerning. And, you know, we know that young people who identify as takatāpui or LGBTQI are more likely to be bullied in schools, are more likely to have mental health issues because of that bullying and the negative environment. So the last thing we want to do is increase that harm. We want our schools to be inclusive environments that are welcoming and supportive of a diversity of young people. So I am concerned about that in the sense it seems like a step backwards. And, you know, we know that we have really concerning mental health stats in New Zealand that we need to do something about. And there is clear indication that mental health problems are very connected to cultures of exclusion, bullying, sexism, racism, homophobia, heteronormativity. You know, those connections are clear. So this does concern me in that sense.
What can rangatahi do if they're concerned about this new policy?
I think young people can absolutely have a strong voice in that. We're seeing that voice right now on social media, but I don't know whether the incoming ministers, you know, will be connected in with that. I think writing to the incoming Minister of Education, Erica Stanford, I mean, this is a New Zealand First policy, really. This is in their coalition agreement. So this seems like, you know, quite a fringe position. And, you know, my hope is that the ministers will actually take a much more even view of this and listen to young people. But I think young people have to have a voice in the political space. They need to be writing to ministers to make sure that their position is on the agenda here.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think we can see what happens in this space. Policies do go through review and updating over time. That's not necessarily a cause for concern, but I think young people absolutely should be having a voice in this to make sure that the gains that we've made in this space, I mean, you go back 20 years and relationship sexuality education in schools was, you know, almost completely absent. We now have made some progress in this to, you know, to support young people, to engage with the kind of complex environment that we're all living in now. And I'd hate to see us go backwards to a time where we're seeing the repression of sex and sexuality, the repression of women and gender diverse communities, Māori and Indigenous ways of understanding gender and sexuality. So we don't want to lose those things, I think, is my key concern. And I'm hopeful that you know, the new Minister of Education will see this as an opportunity to engage young people in this conversation and see what young people actually want.
That was Professor of Education at the University of Auckland, Katie Fitzpatrick, speaking to me about the new government's plan to remove relationship and sexuality education guidelines from the curriculum.
The Wire.
A new report from Our Land and Water has found it will be very challenging to achieve New Zealand's water quality goals. First, I spoke to Tom Snowder, report lead author and director of Land Water People, about their research findings.
This study was the first assessment of where bottom lines, so those are minimum acceptable states for water quality, that are related to poor contaminants, nitrogen, phosphorus, E. coli and sediment, across where the bottom lines are exceeded across New Zealand. And the purpose of the work really was to show how large the gap is between our regulatory bottom lines, our minimum acceptable states, and where currently water quality is.
So what is the current state of our freshwater in Aotearoa?
Well, this study shows that we're currently not achieving our regulatory minimum acceptable states by quite large margins, both at the national scale, but also for at least one contaminant in most regions in New Zealand. And there are some catchments that are not achieving these regulatory minimum standards for several contaminants. So that's not a huge surprise. We've been aware of this for a long time. What this study brings is more explicit quantification of by how much and where these exceedances of national bottom lines are occurring.
For those who might not know, can you tell our listeners about what freshwater encompasses?
Yes, so this study encompasses rivers, lakes and estuaries. And that doesn't account for all freshwaters because, of course, we have groundwater, which is important. That wasn't considered in this study. So this study is focusing on those three, what we call, surface water receiving environments, rivers, lakes and estuaries.
What would the implications be of New Zealand not meeting national freshwater standards?
Yeah, regional councils, under the National Policy Statement for Freshwater, regional councils have to put in place regional plans that will define how those minimum acceptable states will eventually be achieved. The regional councils are currently in the process of preparing those plans, and this information is useful to them because it tells them about the size of that task or the size of the challenge that their plans need to address, and obviously where these problems are occurring, and therefore they're using that process to identify the sorts of actions that they're going to need to take in the future to achieve these minimum acceptable states.
What outcomes do you hope will come from the findings of your research?
What we hope is that this information is useful both to regional and central government primarily. And as I said, the benefit to them is it provides robust quantification of the size of the challenge and the size of the gap and where those challenges are across New Zealand's landscape.
I also spoke to Jenny Webster-Brown, director of Our Land and Water National Science Challenge, about the water standards outlined in the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020. I started off by asking her about what these standards are.
The National Policy Statement for Freshwater, the goal of that legislation is to maintain our water quality where it's good and improve it where it's not. So all the instruments and tools that are contained in that legislation are designed to help us achieve that goal. The 2020 version is simply the latest revision of the NPS, or evolution, if you like, of the NPS freshwater management. The process began in, I think it was heralded in 2011, and there's been three revisions of it so far, because it is an evolving document as we get more and more data and information that supports our approach to improve freshwater quality in New Zealand. The current research, the research that's being released now, is designed to help implement the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management. It shows us where in New Zealand we need to reduce contaminant levels to achieve a national bottom line, that is the lowest water quality that would be acceptable. And it shows how much we need to reduce contaminants flowing off the land into our freshwater systems in order to achieve those national bottom lines. It's very topical at the moment because the implementation of the 2020 version of the NPSFM is the responsibility of regional councils, and they are currently working on this. It has to be in place by next year.
In your opinion, can New Zealand achieve the goals outlined in this national policy statement, and what might we need to do in order to achieve these goals?
The goals in the national policy statement are very achievable, but they won't be achievable unless we make some changes. Those changes will inevitably create pain for some, particularly people on agricultural land, which is currently using the type of farming that leaches a lot of contaminants into the environment. We have always known that. The goals were set knowing that they would require change, that they weren't going to be easily achievable. But if the science community in New Zealand was going to set such goals again, say there was, you know, they decided to redo the NPSFM, the same levels of contaminants that were acceptable would be derived, because it would effectively be using the same data set, and the science is pretty clear on this, that we need to have those contaminant levels reduced to national bottom lines if we are going to achieve good water quality. And New Zealanders feel very strongly about good water quality in our country.
What recommendations would you give to our incoming government when it comes to water management?
Well, my first recommendation obviously would be not to redo the National Policy Statement of Freshwater Management. There are opportunities obviously to work on it, to improve its capabilities as more and more monitoring data becomes available and we learn more and more about the tolerance of our freshwater systems. But to completely replace it and start all over again would be a massive waste of time, and it would leave us with no legislation in the interim. The key thing that we want to emphasise is that the research that's been released now is not intended to be recommending in any way that the national bottom lines be changed. It is simply an indication of where we need to spend the money, where we need to invest in order to meet the national bottom lines. So it defines which contaminants, whereabouts in New Zealand we have to invest the most effort, and how much we need to reduce those contaminant loads to meet our national policy statement for freshwater management. It's meant to be a supporting piece of information, not a critique of the national policy statement's aims and objectives.
That was report lead author and director of Land, Water, People, Ton Snelder, followed by director of Our Land and Water National Science Challenge, Ginny Webster-Brown, talking about new research into New Zealand's water quality.
That was The Wire.
That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Thursday. Rapari Thursday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Nira hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to our producer, Beth. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Eli. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.